It's called the worst 45-minute film that you will ever see. It's a film that right now people are walking out of. They're walking out of the room after having seen it completely silent. They're walking out of the room crying. They're walking out of the room not knowing what to think. They're described as shell-shocked. It's a 45-minute film that is detailing the atrocities that were committed on October 7th. When Hamas came in, attacked Israel, they massacred 1,400 innocent Israeli citizens, including mass rapes, tortures, bonding and immolation of toddlers, beheadings, and live mutilation. The Israeli Defense Force caught much of this on camera. They compiled that into a 45-minute film. And it's one that no one wants to see. It's a dark reality, though, in our world that has to be faced. It was an evil day, and I'm sure many of you, like me, when you started seeing some of those reports, you just felt it down to your bones that you wanted to do something about it, and there was nothing that the Israelis could do in that moment that would have been too severe. They couldn't spill enough blood. At the moment, it was my thought that the only way you could defeat evil was to become evil. But then again, that doesn't really work, does it? Becoming like the ones that need to be defeated. See, the problem becomes navigating through two different sins that can happen in a moment like this, when you are faced with something so atrocious that you don't know what to do. One is that you can fall into the sin of sort of self-preservation, that I don't know what to do, I don't feel like I can do something, therefore I will do nothing. But there's another sin that we can fall into as well, which is the sin of revenge, that I want to make them pay for what they did because I want to try and vent my anger. And that's when we try to become evil, to defeat evil. But evil needs a response. Evil demands a response. And what I want to talk about this morning then is, well, what is the Christian response to evil? How should Christians rightly respond to evil? We're going to be back in the book of Genesis this morning, picking up where we left off back before Thanksgiving. We'll be in Genesis chapter 34. This is a long passage. I'm going to ask you to stay in your seats today. Normally we would stand out of respect for the Word of God, but this is a lengthy passage, and I decided I want to read it all, because if you don't read it all, you're going to leave part of the narrative out that's going to be essential to understanding what's happening. Genesis chapter 34, I'll be starting with verse 1 of Genesis chapter 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl for my wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. The sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they heard of it, and the men were indignant and very angry, because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us and the land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it and get property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me I will give." Ask for me as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife. The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully, because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter, and we will be gone." Their words pleased Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most honored of all his father's house. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters as wives, and let's give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men agree to dwell with us, to become one people, when every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us." And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. On the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure, and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword, and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city, because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and the field, all their wealth, all their little ones, and their wives, all that was in the houses, they captured and plundered. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You've brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" We're heading back into the book of Genesis. These people are now in the land, Jacob and his wives and his children. And they're back in the land of Canaan. He left Laban, and now he's there. And we see people learning, and they are learning, how to live with a dependence on God, to trust him no matter their circumstances, because he keeps his promises. And this morning, I want to look at the passage this way. First, we'll talk about the rise of evil, then the result of evil, and then how do we react to evil? The rise, the result, and then finally the reaction. Now, it's been a while since we've been in Genesis. Let's do a quick review about what's been going on the last couple of chapters. If you recall, it was Abraham, then he had Isaac, then he had Jacob. Jacob, he went to the land of his uncle Laban, because his brother Esau was murderously angry. He gets there, he marries Rachel, he marries Leah. He starts raising up all kinds of animals, and he's growing wealthy. And then God said, "I want you to leave here. I want you to go back to the land that I promised you." On the way back to the land that he was promised, he runs back into Esau, and they are reconciled. So life is good. Things are going very, very well as Jacob is now dwelling in the land. He should be enjoying the promises of God, being fruitful, multiplying. But Jacob has a history, a long history, of not trusting God, of taking matters into their own hands, and causing great harm as a result. And we'll see this morning that when evil and sin, when they escalate, the only thing that you can ever expect is there to be a lot of confusion and a lot of complication. And it's the enemy of God's blessing of peace and joy and love. And now we're seeing more of the same. So then let's look at this rise of evil. You know, sometimes one person will take one little rock off of a hill and it causes an entire avalanche. We see here a young woman, probably about 14 years old, going out, only wanting to see the women of the land, and something horrible and painful happens. It's painful to read. I'm sure it's hard for many of you to hear what happened to Jacob's daughter, an innocent young woman, and these brutal acts of evil. And it makes it clear in the text that evil was done to Dinah. Look at this succession of actions in verse 2. When Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her, he lay with her, and humiliated her. This is a picture of evil. And it very much mirrors the language that we saw in chapter 6, verse 2. What happened when the sons of God found the daughters of women beautiful? They were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Very similar language. It's a picture of evil. There's three rapes recorded in the Old Testament. The act would defile sometimes an entire community of people, and the Hivites would have been part of this larger Canaanite community, and this occurrence illustrates these low moral standards of the Canaanites. They believed that there was nothing wrong with what they did, that if you saw a woman, you could simply take her, and you could do with you what you wanted to her, any unattended female this could happen to. As we go through this, neither the son nor the father have any sense of apologizing. They don't have a sense that even that an evil has been done here. It was normal for them. And after Shechem committed this act, he senses some kind of a feeling for her. It's strange. First, he just saw her as an object, and now he's claiming that he's in love with her, that he has feelings for her, and he wants her for a wife. And four times in verses 1 through 7, Dinah is called Jacob's daughter. And there's a point to that. The relationship is being emphasized again and again and again because the question is going to come up, okay, Jacob, how are you going to handle this? Jacob, father, what are you going to do here? We'll recall that this is Leah's daughter. Leah was the one that Jacob did not want. He was tricked into marrying her, not the one he originally wanted. And Jacob's response against this crime is what you could call underwhelming, to say the least. By the way, he's going to have a fit in just a few chapters when something that happens to one of Rachel's sons. He's going to go nuts. He's going to go out of his mind. But here, there's little to no reaction as to what's happening. Nowhere in this passage he ever referred to himself as Dinah's father. He's being neglectful. And that lack of response is setting the stage for the response of Dinah's brothers. Now see, Jacob, he's just looking for a way to self-preserve in all of this. It's about him. And this is the old Jacob. A marriage proposal is going to come from Shechem's father Hamor, and there's all kinds of promises of wealth, and they're made to Jacob and his sons. And Jacob is just taking it all in. And then look at verses 11 and 12. Shechem also said to her father and her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me for as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife." Promises. Jacob shouldn't even be listening to all this. He shouldn't be hearing this. He should be in sackcloth and ashes, mourning this great evil that was done to his daughter. But his sons are furious. By the way, it was their full sister, Dinah was their full sister, that was raped. They intend to respond. Look at verse 13. The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They got a plan, and the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. They'll be deceitful, like old dad was deceitful. If you recall, Jacob dressed up in fur to trick granddad, to make him think that he was Esau. They're going to pull a fast on themselves. What are they going to do? Well, Shechem and Hamor, sorry, we can't intermarry with uncircumcised people. God gave us laws, but if you get your men all circumcised up, we'll marry each other. Our daughter will be one big happy family. Because dad didn't respond, the brothers are going to do it their way. Now, there's two important facts we need to point out. First of all, worldly evil will frequently prey on God's children. Frequently. If the world and its systems are all backed up by the evil one, by Satan, he's going to be conniving to try and work things in a certain direction against God's children. And there's focused attacks on in Jacob's day on Jews, in our days it's against Christians. I was just reading, there was a group called Open Doors USA, figures that 360 million Christians last year lived in countries where persecution was significant. And 5,600 Christians were murdered, 6,000 were detained or imprisoned, another 4,000 plus were kidnapped, more than 5,000 churches and other religious facilities were destroyed. We've got it pretty good here. We've got more than pretty good here. We got really good here. But there's evil rising up all around. There's a second point to be made here, and it's the tendency to not respond to evil. That people have this tendency not to respond to evil when they see it, when they know it. Now, it could have been, again, that Jacob was just kind of resting on his laurels. I mean, life was good right now. They were getting the land. They were acquiring wealth, lots of livestock, lots of kids. He's comfortable, and he's getting apathetic. He's not willing to fight anymore. When you become apathetic, it means you're no longer interested or concerned. You know, a man asked his wife in a way to get her to tell him what was the definition of apathy, and he was saying it in such a way that she knew that he already knew and was just trying to impress her with how smart he was. And he looked at her and said, "So what is apathy?" And she said, "Well, I don't know and I don't care." Okay? It's a good definition of apathy. Jacob is negligent, he's lazy, he's sinful, and he's apathetic in what's happening here. And it's easy for it to happen. If you recall back in this is sort of back in my neck of the woods in Pennsylvania in 2011 at Penn State University. There was a series of molestations of children that were covered up within the football community back there. And it came out that Joe Paterno, the head coach, knew, the assistant coach knew, people in administration, they knew what was going on. It went unreported. There was, in response to that, there was an article came out called "Let's All Feel Superior." And the writer said, "We have a tendency to ignore our own sin as we notice the sins of others." Now, absolutely, these people should have called out what was happening to those kids. That should be a no-brainer. This author is going to go on to make the point, though, to be careful when you say, "Well, if I had been there, this would never have happened." He goes on to say again that we ignore our own sins, we notice the sins of others. He stated that many commentators contemptuously asked, "How could they have let this happen? Because we assume that we would have done better than they did." The article notes that the historical record shows how often ordinary people don't get involved in tragic or unjust situation. If you look at the Rwandan genocide, if you look at the ordinary crime and violence that goes on in the streets of America, there's a name for it. It's called the bystander effect. And the article goes on, "In centuries past, people built moral systems that acknowledged this weakness. These systems emphasized our sinfulness. They reminded people of the evil within themselves. Unfortunately today, quote, we live in a society oriented around our inner wonderfulness. So when something terrible happens, we always try to blame it on someone else." The writer of that article was a Christian, said it's easy to vilify others from the island of our own innocence. It's easy to ask, how could they have let this happen? But he goes on to say, how can we ourselves overcome our natural tendency to evade and self-deceive? It's a question we have a hard time asking, because the most seductive evasion is the one that leads us to deny the underside of our own nature. Again, it's easy to say, well, if I had been there, it would be different. But history seems to state that it probably wouldn't. If we're going to call ourselves Christians, though, we've got to respond to evil. It should make us angry. There is a righteous indignancy that should occur against evil, but how angry? And then how to respond? Let's keep going. Let's look at this result of evil. It was a continuation of the quote. Result of evil. So Jacob responded with little love toward his daughter, Dinah. She had a great evil done against her. Her brothers want revenge. Now, we have a whole city of men at this point that are newly circumcised, which, by the way, is ridiculous. The point of circumcision was to, there was a religious point to this that showed that you were in covenant with God, not to just demarcate yourself as a certain people group if they didn't worship Yahweh. So these brothers are making a mockery of circumcision, the point of it. And again, where's Jacob in all this? He's silent. And Hamor and Shechem go back to their people proclaiming that they're what all they're about to gain. Verse 23, will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us. But that is not how this is going to go down. It won't be the Hivites that acquire everything from the Israelites. And in the absence of any real response or any leadership from Jacob, who's been passive and negligent, no assertion against these Hivites that raped his daughter, then wanted to marry her without any sense of remorse, just all of a sudden he's got feelings for her. His sons now have a bloodlust, and they step in. And the Hivite men, they're kind of just sort of laying around, a bit sore. There were no scalpels back then. It was a piece of flint. And Simeon and Levi, as it says in verse 25, proceed to take their swords, and while the men of the city felt secure, they killed them all, got their sister, took her out. But it didn't stop there. The other sons of Jacob come along. And then what happens in verse 29? All their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses, they captured and plundered. There was no call for this level of violence, for the sin of one man. But again, we're looking back, it was Jacob's failure to act that is leading to this. And it resulted in these violence by his sons, where the sister was taken by force. They end up taking all the women by force. And this is what happens when evil goes unchecked. It escalates. And this will happen in a church. It will happen in your family. It can happen anywhere. Evil has to be checked. It escalates. There was a woman who survived the Holocaust and became a political philosopher after that. Her name was Hannah Arendt. She said this. She said, evil thrives on apathy and cannot survive without it. It's true. Another quote. This is by John Mill, something along the same lines. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. That was part of an inaugural address at the University of St. Andrews. He went on to say, let not anyone pacify his conscience by the delusion that he can do no harm if he takes no part and forms no opinion. Bad men need nothing more to accomplish their ends than that good men should look on and do nothing. He is not a good man who, without a protest, allows wrong to be committed in his name and with the means which he helps to supply, because he doesn't want to trouble himself. There is a truth to step up, a need to step up. And that brings us to the last point. Well, how do we react to evil? How do we react to evil? I don't want to oversimplify this. How should that reaction look? And I think there's some stages here about thinking and speaking and acting. And if we are going to respond to evil first, well, we got to think rightly about evil. Number one, we got to think rightly about evil, and namely in the culture that we live in, that evil exists. It is real. It is out there. It does happen. And we're in a culture that really needs and tries to explain away evil. Now, why is that? Because if there's a standard of evil, if you can recognize it, and we all know there is, then there is evidence that God exists. Now, some people get this backward. They think, well, how can there be a God if evil exists? I mean, isn't that an argument against God? How can there be a God if there is evil? C.S. Lewis conquered this question in his book, Mere Christianity. By the way, we should all be reading the Bible. If every one of you are reading the scriptures, but I would say, secondly, you need to pick up the book, Mere Christianity. If you've not read that, it's an important one to read. In the earlier part of C.S. Lewis's life, he was an atheist whose chief reason for not believing, he said, was all the injustice in the world. And he realized, however, there was a problem with his reasoning. And he said this, he said, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But this is the question he had to ask himself. How had I got this idea of just and unjust? He had to ask himself, well, wait a minute, where did this come from? He goes on to say, a man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? You see, that's the golden question. I hear lots of people that are absolutely atheistic who are also screaming about the injustice in the world, but what they can't do is explain, well, how do you know what is unjust without some standard of good and evil? He said, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my fancies. Thus, in the very act of trying to prove that God did not exist, I found I was forced to assume that one part of reality, namely my idea of justice, was full of sense. He would say, if anybody ever argues against God, there is no standard of good or evil. He said, well, just steal something from them. And then see if they still have that same sense that there is no real good or evil. You know, interestingly, if you're paying attention to what's going on in the culture, they are coming up with all of these alternative fairy tales. Have you noticed this? You know, it used to be we were satisfied with like Little Red Riding Hood, where there was an evil wolf. You know, there was Sleeping Beauty, where there was the evil Maleficent. There was there was the Wizard of Oz, where there was an evil queen. But now you've got these other fairy tales coming out. And they're addressing this because culture doesn't like this. Culture doesn't want to call evil evil. So you get a backstory. These people are just misunderstood. The Wicked Witch, she had a bad upbringing. Maleficent, she had her own tragedies to deal with. This is an old, old heresy. If you've been on Thursday nights, we've been talking about this. Theology Thursday, they called it Pelagianism. It's the idea that people are not inherently evil. They've just had bad role models. And I'll tell you, that is still around today. No, there is evil. Chad Cowan was born evil. The gospel is the only hope against evil, even recognizing evil. And where the gospel is absent and Christ is absent, then you would expect people to try to make themselves their own gods, and they will determine what is good and what is evil. Now, you got to think rightly about this because you got to be thinking upstream against the culture on this. So it is real, and it needs to be called out. It needs to be called out. Don't let it go unchecked. Speak against it. Don't let our post-Christian culture tell you what is right and what is wrong. Lust is a sin. Adultery is a sin. Homosexuality is a sin. Premarital sex is a sin. The law of Moses would have told these people, do not intermarry with the Canaanites. Don't do it. They want to swallow you up. And this passage gives us part of the rationale for such laws. And it shows us how immoral the Canaanites were by defiling the Israelites by this sexual conduct, trying to marry into them and swallowing them up. Recognize it. You may need to speak up against it. Now, it's easy for me to stand here and speak out about all of these sins, and we're all in agreement, but you might need to speak up towards someone that's sitting beside you, behind you, or in front of you. Now, that takes courage. It takes courage to speak up when it's somebody you love, and it's somebody that you love enough to say, I love you too much to let you continue in the way you're going. But if we go to Matthew 18:18-20, that's exactly what the text says. If someone sins, confront them. If they sin against you, confront them. Love them. Speak up. And then finally, it may require action. It may require action in addition to speaking up. Where is evil happening? Where is it happening around you? Well, you may need to confront it if it's safe, if it's possible. You may need to inform police when you see it happening or suspect it happening. You may need to come to the elders and let them know this is what's happening. It may require action on behalf of the elders. If you've confronted someone and you and your friend have confronted that person, they are not changing. The matter is becoming an issue of church-wide discipline. This happens. It's not fun. But see, the church is helping to hold evil in check. The evil that happens in this room. And yes, there may be a time, I hope it never happens to any of us, that you may need to use lethal force if you have the means to. If you can save an innocent life, if you can save an innocent child, and you've got the means to do it, there are times when you need to do it. Put this all together. Make a difference in the world by responding Christianly to evil. Make a difference in this world by responding Christianly to evil. Please pray with me. Father, we thank you that you have given us the ability to recognize evil. Lord, you did not leave it unchecked. You sent your own Son here to pay the price of the evil in the world. He took it on himself. That all the evils that I have committed, Jesus took on himself. And for each and every other person in this room, that they can simply trust in what he did to be forgiven. And Lord, help us to see it, to respond to it, to think rightly about it, that it is here in our world. At times we need to speak up. We need to act. Lord, now as we go into this time of communion, I pray that we would remember what it took, the sacrifice of your own Son, to pay for the evil and the sin in this world. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.